Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Anne McElvoy, head of Economist Radio, and welcome to The Economist's Cultural Review of 2016 and our look ahead to 2017. To start, I've asked our two guests to take a very personal look at the past 12 months. They're two of our senior editors, Fiametta Rocco and Jonathan Beckman. Welcome to you both. So, Fiametta, arts and books editor no less, you've got a great waterfront on what has happened in the arts in the past year, but now you have to choose your darlings.
Well, I think if I look back, I can see myself sitting in bed reading a typescript of a book called Meetings with Remarkable Manuscripts. It's written by Christopher de Hamel, who has literally examined more medieval manuscripts than any human who has ever walked this earth. And he can write. It's simply wonderful. Very, very political, very revealing, and really quite a surprise. And my other memory, I think, would be standing outside Tate Modern in the pouring rain on the 16th of June when it opened. It is remarkable how the art world was anti-Brexit, anti-leaving, and that opening of Tate Modern, I think, really epitomised it for me.
Jonathan, your top tips of the year.
Well, I think for the second year in a row, the Booker Prize judges got it right and chose The Sellout, which was, I thought, a fantastic, scabrous, blasphemous and very funny novel. But it was a very interesting shortlist, and I believe that the book that almost won it was David Shloy's All That Man Is, which is also an incredibly accomplished piece of work and comic in a much more muted vein. The best shows I've seen this year have all, strange enough, been a video art, or at least moving image. There was The Infinite Mix, the Haywards show of 10 contemporary artists at the store in the Strand, which was a bit of an infinite mixed bag, but contained some fantastic pieces, particularly Khalil Joseph's Mad about Compton in Los Angeles. There was Piplotti's Pixel Forest in the New Museum in New York, which is surreal and celebrates all that's nubby and stubby and protuberant. My favourite show, there was William Kentridge's Thick Time at the Whitechapel Gallery in London. He's got such a fecund imagination. It combines video and animation and strange portmanteau sculptures and is elusive and inventive and highly intelligent.
And what about you? You get to see a lot of things.
Yes, I'm going to go for gender-bending Shakespeare as my top trend of 2016, and I'm sure is going to tip us into 2017. I saw Glenda Jackson as Lear, very praised production at the Old Vic in London. I think also given Glenda Jackson's own age, perfect for playing Lear, that was quite an event. But I had a slight preference for Harriet Walter, who was finishing off her trilogy for the Donmar. She was finishing it as Prospero. If there was ever a part that would lend itself to some gender magic, that must surely be it. I am beginning to wonder, however, when we see male actors going up to their agent saying, I've got to do Lady Macbeth. I'm going to pick film of the year, for me a documentary film of the year, which was Wiener, the extraordinary story of a poor old Wiener, or depending which way you look at it, who gets himself into an awful lot of trouble. He's, of course, married to an aide of Hillary Clinton's, and it was a sort of disaster saga about his own career as he ran for office in New York while caught up in an increasingly scabrous texting and sexting scandal. But I think it said such a lot about spin, about politics, and it turned out to be rather predictive, didn't it, of the sort of decline of mainstream Democrat politics in the US this year. Fiametta, any other treats of the year when you're not slaving over hot pages? I like to think that you get out and about, and indeed you get out and about a bit globally.
I do get out and about a bit globally, but I have to say that my most favourite time is reading. And this has been a year for some extraordinary translated fiction. In fact, this is where the most interesting fiction is being written. And I think my choice for this year would be certainly the most erotic novel I read all year was The Vegetarian by Han Kang. Very slim, little Korean novel that blew into our world when it won the Man Booker International Prize in May. Extraordinary book.
Jonathan, any erotic fiction on your horizon in 2016?
I'm afraid I've left erotic fiction rather behind me, but I do think there's, I mean, what is that increasingly finding is kind of hybrid non-fiction books that are kind of doing so many of the things that we want novels to do. I particularly liked Olivia Lang's The Lonely City, which was part memoir, part art history, very personal and kind of tender art history, and a book that was a meditation on what it means to be alone in a city and what's the kind of the melancholy and the awareness that gives you.
You do pick up on an interesting trend there that a lot of readers or indeed publishers who would once be looking for fiction now maybe looking at something that is blurring the boundaries of fiction and non-fiction more. Do you see that too, Fiametta?
I absolutely see it. And one of the places where you really do see it is in graphic novels, which are, you know, not really comics, but they are novels and they're incredibly moving. Two that have come out this year have been extraordinary. One is Proust, the most loquacious, wordy writer, actually lends himself brilliantly to graphic novels. And one is a strange book about growing up in Singapore. So this completely quiet, safe, efficient country also lends itself to that great kind of human grappling mess that the best graphic novel is.
On the human grappling mess, I'm going to pick another highlight of my year, which was after about 20 years of trying, finally getting to Bayreuth, to the opera there to do some commentary on Wagner and the Ring cycle. And I think for anyone who loves opera or is even just interested in opera and in the staging of Wagner, it has to be a sort of lifetime ambition. And it's one of the things that when you get there, it's about, you've imagined everything to be very grand and you find that you've gone to quite a small town with a sort of moderately small auditorium and people in a slightly unfortunate German evening dress. And actually, it is a very sort of fun experience, as well as, of course, the seriousness of Wagner and the way that everybody is sort of silent and transformed by it and goes into a kind of trance, and then as soon as it's over then starts gabbling manically about what they've seen. So I thought it was, as a piece of opera, exactly what Wagner did want. He wanted the Gesamtkunstwerk, the total work of art, and guess what? Even in 2016, Bayreuth does provide that. 2017 is the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution. I'm joined by The Economist's Russia and Eastern Europe correspondent Arkady Ostrovsky. Arkady, we know that here in London there's a wave of films, there are new books coming, there were going to be exhibitions. But how is this being perceived in Russia?
Well, this is probably one of the most difficult events for Russia to mark, or I should say for President Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin to mark. Because on the one hand, Putin has a natural aversion to any idea of a revolution, particularly the one directed against corrupt authoritarian regimes that refuse to share power. On the other hand, he has borrowed so much from the Soviet period in terms of symbolism, in terms of the Soviet national anthem, in terms of presenting the current Russia as a continuation of both the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union. To him, there is very little difference between the Soviet Union and Russia today. So he's taken so much from the Soviet period that he can't just ignore it. Putin is very uncomfortable with Lenin actually lying in the center of Moscow in Red Square. In fact, when he first came to power, there was a serious discussion about burying Lenin. So what they've done instead, not wanting to upset the communists and the a lot of Russian people, they drape it. They cover it in the ribbons and the cloth of the Second World War victory, because that's the element which is sort of legitimizing power. So for him, this is a very difficult mark of how to reconcile the idea of Russian Empire, the aversion to revolution, and the Soviet past and its symbolism, which he brought back.
And more broadly, you know, whatever the clampdowns at the top throughout Russia under Vladimir Putin, there's still quite a lively art scene. You know, there's a lot of contemporary art. There are quite edgy exhibitions that go on. So how do you think that the arts community is seeing this? Is it an opportunity to do something interesting, or is it something that the state is just doing over there best to be got through with a couple of drinks and then continue?
That's a very good question. So the revolution results in this amazing cultural explosion. It unleashes and releases enormous artistic energy. Today, it's a much more tame cultural scene. As I said, the legacy of the revolution in Russia is this very schizophrenic experience, because it's not something people can abstractly talk about or in the way that they can do in the West. You know, people who are creating art today are people who were born in the Soviet Union, a lot of them, who lived with the consequences of the revolution. The artists, interestingly, who are picking up on it, isn't it like Pussy Riot, is probably the best sort of expression of that energy. But people, you know, for a lot of people in Russia, it's a real event, and they lived for 70 years with the consequences of it. And the last thing I would say is that the way Putin is dealing with it is very interesting. They seem to have come up with a new narrative. As you know, there were two revolutions actually taking place that year. There was a February revolution of 1917, which created the interim government, and which was a bourgeois revolution. And then there was October Revolution of the Bolsheviks. And these were two contrary events. Putin's decided to lump them all together and saying, look, we're celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Great Russian Revolution. Never mind what it did. It was just a great Russian event.
Thank you, Arkady. And Arkady, you won the Orwell Prize for your book on Russia this year, did you not?
Yes.
Another one coming next year?
Not next year. I think books take a lot longer. But yes, I'm working on an idea for the next book.
Pastor Vlayev Tibia. Congratulations. Thank you. So, Fiametta, Jonathan, we're laying in the stocks for New Year's Eve. But what's 2017 got in store for us? Fiametta.
Well, you know, there are museums of contemporary art absolutely everywhere now. There's even somebody planning an Antarctic biennial for next year. But I think the real attention next year is going to be back in Europe. Once a decade, there's a confluence of art shows, the Venice Biennale, Documenta in Kassel, and the Sculpture Project in Munster. It only happens once every 10 years, and it's a very, very good moment to see what's really interesting to artists. Last time these big shows all happened together in 2007 was the moment when Ai Weiwei became a global name. And I think next year we're going to see two things. We're going to see a lot of political art and a lot of performance art. This has been a growing trend and it's ready to become quite mainstream. It's very, very, very popular at biennials. And it's really art without walls. I mean, young people increasingly in Europe and in America are allergic to stuff. They want experiences. And particularly if there's audience participation, this kind of performance art, you know, it's a special moment. You're there when it's happening and then it disappears. They love it.
I'm just going to put you very briefly on the spot on that. Performance art, is that now what immersive theatre was a few years ago? Some very good pieces came out of it. I sat through quite a lot of bad immersive theatre. Are you convinced that theatre without walls or performance art can sort of raise its quality to a consistency where we don't just say, well, that was an interesting idea, but a day later we've forgotten what it was all about?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. There's a growing trend that we see, particularly in Europe, I think, of young people who have become increasingly allergic to stuff. What they really like are experiences. And this is forcing artists to raise their game, particularly in those performance things where the audience is involved. So it's a moment, you're part of it, and then suddenly it's gone. But, you know, if you look back at Marina Abramovic, at Olafur Eliasson, Tina Segal, all of these people who are really the best of the best in the art world, they're about to become global names.
You're sticking up for it. Quite right, too. Jonathan, one thing that struck me was the opening of Hamilton in the UK to a very different political context than that to which it was originally composed coming up in this year ahead.
Hamilton is this smash Broadway hit that seemed to be about, you know, this post-racial state that America had found itself in the Obama era, comes to Europe, you know, this year in a very different political context, about a man who did his best to strengthen the hand of the federal government at a time when the man in charge of the federal government may be doing lots of things that people don't find particularly attractive. So I think it'll be interesting to see how it plays out once, you know, it's come here and Trump has had 9 months in power. Also how people here respond to it. You know, Americans love American history. I don't think English people love American history very much. And you see all of these enormous Pulitzer Prize-winning books that barely find publishers in this country and sell, you know, a handful of copies because we seem to have very little interest in it. So whether the show itself will take off here as much as it did in the States, I don't know.
I'm going to bet you it will, because I think Hamilton is just seen as an event. And as you point out, that many people in the audience will be going to not knowing at all who Hamilton is.
And that may be true.
I'm going to lay you a bet and we'll come back to studio next year and see whether it was a hit or a miss. Fear Meta, something else.
Well, I'm going to cross the Atlantic the other way. The show I'm most interested in is called Art and China After 1989, Theatre of the World. It's going to open at the Guggenheim in October, and it'll be the biggest exhibition of Chinese experimental art ever. I think what's really interesting about it is that it's got probably three of the best curators on China: Alexandra Monroe from the Guggenheim, Phil Tenari from the Ulen Center in Beijing, and Hu Hanru, who's now at the Maxi in Rome. They probably together have been working on this all their lives. And the starting point, of course, you know, 1989, Berlin Wall came down, dissolving the old post-war order. The internet was invented, which gave rise to globalization, to borderless world. In China, decade of reform was crushed in Tiananmen Square. And in the art world, there was an extraordinary exhibition at the Pompidou Zoo Center called The Magicians of the Earth. People still talk about it. And I think that's what this show is going to be. These three people are going to teach us how to think about art in China in relation to the times that we live in.
Well, one book I'm looking forward to this year is George Saunders' debut novel, Lincoln in Bardo, which Saunders is one of the great short story writers of our time, but writing short stories and writing novels are very different things. So we'll see whether that's a success. But again, it's a highly charged subject to write about Lincoln. You know, it's about the death of Lincoln's son at the height of the Civil War, at a time when every president who comes compares themselves to Lincoln, but some are more Lincoln-esque than others, I suppose.
I thought I'd put in a word for pop and rock. One of the big events I enjoyed a lot in 2016 was New Order concert, and just seeing New Order again, one of those 80s bands together, reaching back also to Joy Division, who went before them, and this audience, which was such a mixture generationally, and I felt like I'd finally proved the point against people in my family who said when I was growing up, oh, it will all pass. Here we all are, you know, knocking on a little bit in the years, and these bands are having revivals. More of that, I think, in 2017. There's a big Coldplay tour coming up for people who like that sort of thing. I have some devotees in my household and some of us who go into catatonic trance at the thought, but also bouncy Britpop, Squeeze, some people will remember, pre-1989, by a good way, I think 1980, some of its hits, will reform. And as someone said to me, who knows that there's there is a point when all the feuds get put away and the desire to go on tour again exceeds the desire to prolong feuds which have gone on for 40 years, which I think is the industry norm, Jonathan.
Yeah, often the financial need to go on tour as well is
I think there's sometimes a financial need, but you can often sort of tell, and when that's the case. I saw The Who and I saw New Order this year, and I think they all have other ways of making money. I think they wanted to do again. Lesson for 2017, if you've still got each other's phone numbers, you're probably going to be touring. Well, that's all for this year. To read more about all of the topics we've discussed in this show, do pick up the new issue of The Economist, our Christmas edition. In fact, you can find us online at economist.com and, of course, our magazine too, 1843. In London, this is The Economist.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.